I have nothing to disclose, except I'm here. I hope my presentation isn't too confusing because methodologically it's not very discrete at all. Because even though it talks about, well, just from the title, it kind of comes from my own academic background that it ends up being about power and politics. The identities are really shaped by the historical, political, social context. It's very difficult to quantify this, although at the same time I'm very interested in the molecular image. So what I'm trying to do is to try to tie together a molecular understanding of linkages between social determinants of health and individual health outcomes, as well as to tie that to a post-structural, post-modern, post-colonial view of the world, and how ultimately that makes the interventions as a physician, that my interventions are ultimately very difficult, the ones that I have in my toolkit, because in order to make a difference, we need to have a revolutionary change. So if that's confusing enough to you, it may get even worse. Okay. So we're going to look at the historical evolution of the Sikh Hawaiian identity. Evaluate the Sikh Hawaiian identity in political, economic, and social and cultural context, and then explain how epigenetics may articulate this with individual outcomes. So, He'au Maoli, that's the Hawaiian world before contact, before invasion. Now, this is very controversial, of course, in itself, the population estimates, but I tend to use 800,000 to a million people plus, and this was with, quote, Stone Age technology. That is, the population of Hawaii now is about 1.4 million with a fully dependent, 90% plus of the food is imported from other places. But before 1778, all the food was produced for almost the same population, a very healthy population. In fact, if you read Cook and Vancouver, they'll be talking about that the people were meeting them 1 to 2 miles offshore on surfboards. You know, they weren't meeting them in power craft. They weren't meeting them on canoes even. They were surfing 1 to 2 miles offshore. Now, most people, if they do that now, they're towing with a jet ski. But the ancestors were paddling that far out. They're self-sufficient in production, and it was the most developed aquaculture system in the world. There was no evidence of tuberculosis, leprosy, or syphilis. But unfortunately, those diseases quickly became part of the epidemiology of indigenous peoples of both Hawaii and across the world. Negative population growth, at least until 1878, more than 95% depopulation. And I'm just going to go quickly because I have many slides and not enough time. So just some pictures from Herb Kane and others. Initial discovery coming in canoes, sailing. If you think of it, I mean, there's many different origin stories, but if you think of the origin stories from the Marquesas and Tahiti, people were sailing initially with no idea that there was another place. They were sailing with navigation by the stars and by the ocean currents. There was no GPS, of course, back then. The origin stories are multifactorial, Pele and many others. But this is showing what happened with population, is that, of course, in the beginning, 800,000 to 1 million full Hawaiians, and by 1892 was the last census, it was down to 40-something thousand. Today, there's about 400,000 in Hawaii and many more across the world. There's a little diaspora, little enclaves, or kipuka, as we would say, scattered throughout, not just Hawaii, but as far as Italy, because of intermarriage. Diabetes prevalence up to 16.1%, and earlier diagnosis and higher morbidity and mortality than other residents of Hawaii. Higher rates of smoking, alcohol use, overweight and obesity, depression, anxiety, suicide attempts in the adolescent. So this is sort of like what one of my friends in Aotearoa in New Zealand says, we're going to be starting seeing the mad, bad, or sad indigenous person. So we'll see that there was a change in that because the stereotypes for a long time, lazy, obese, drunk, poorly performing academically, surfing, playing ukulele, promiscuity, when women, happy-go-lucky versus the mad, sad, bad, or a sick. So some of the images, and a lot of, you know, it's interesting, you know, as far as like looking at body images, that a lot of the body images you'll see of Hawaiian people may be more Asian than Hawaiian, but just some generic pictures. And then, of course, now there's much more of a resurgence of identity and political power, so leading to the mad stereotype. So there was a change, you know, certainly the Hawaii Visitors Bureau and others, and beginning before the 19, you know, before the 20th century, there was Hawaii was the paradise, the place where people were happy and sun and things like this. And then changing, you know, gradually as indigenous people were marginalized, or by that time, the start of the tourism industry, which was, ironically enough, closely associated with the overthrow of the kingdom. It's pretty obvious why. I mean, overthrow of the kingdom, becoming a tourist paradise. That the happy people became the mad, sad, bad people, and the sick people. So what I'm really interested in this presentation is pathways. Now, besides the sort of postmodern, postcolonial one, another one of them is, of course, on the molecular level. So the thrifty gene has been one of the things that have been tried all over the world to try and explain why people are obese. That during times of fat, people become fat. During times of famine, people use those stores in order to survive. And the problem is that it's a tautology. It has over-explanation, so it basically has no explanation. That there isn't such a gene as the thrifty gene, and that, in fact, it's shifting the burden onto the people who, in fact, are undergoing the effects of colonization, of acculturative stress, of social exclusion. What are some of the other pathways? And the problem is that these pathways are very difficult to trace because you need longitudinal studies, and we know that Native Hawaiians aren't even part of NHANES. So we don't have a lot of the data that we really need to try and start to look at this. Not only that, I mean, how do you specifically define how much of the load, allostatic load, results from the overthrow of the kingdom in 1893? Or how much of it do you attribute to the to losing one's family lands, or to seeing one's ancestors, the bones of one's ancestors exposed as part of construction? This is difficult, but maybe I mean, and this is very, I guess, controversial argument. But maybe it's not all that important, because if we know that it's important, then something needs to be done about it. Whether or not we can, you know, define it in a quantitative way, we have to do it qualitatively, and then we have to, you know, we're driven to take action on it. So some of the pathways, cultural loss and acculturative stress, has been talked about, except for the cultural loss part. Hypothalamic pituitary adrenal sympathetic pathway, allostatic load, development origins of health and disease, fetal programming, intergenerational cultural trauma and epigenetics. So cultural loss and stress. My voice is stressed since I'm speaking a little bit fast, but we're not talking about that. That is that historical events or cultural losses, whether that's language, and this is a very different model than that of a voluntary immigrant, because indigenous people, of course, didn't choose to become part of America. America chose to become part of them, sort of, if that makes sense. It's an unbalanced culture contact. A lot of people, especially Americans, they don't realize the history of Hawaii. Just like they have somewhat limited knowledge, maybe, of the history of the American Indians. So that it's not a peaceful history. It's a violent history, and it's a violent history from several points of view. Together with the Philippines, for example, there was a guerrilla war in the Philippines that a lot of people don't know about. That certainly, you know, some of that resentment isn't necessarily just from the exclusion, it's also from the fact that there's not a sense of obligation. For example, the Filipino veterans who only recently got recognition as veterans. So the unbalanced cultural contact leads to the loss of language. Language was illegal to teach from 1896 to 1976. You have negative social outcomes, family and other stress, and then the resulting problems. And on the level of the brain, of course, it's acting on three major areas: the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, and the hippocampus. And you can see that the hippocampus is involved in emotional contact of memories, and that if you have emotional contact of memories, context of memories, you're going to have very strong memories. Versus if you have memories that are associated with drinking water, for example, that's a very facile memory, and you're much more likely to forget it. That we know that there's a lot of limbic neuroplasticity, that is the limbic system involving the hippocampus, the amygdala, is very plastic. Just we know the brain is now very plastic, that it's not, we used to think that there's no possibility for regenerating of neurons during after birth, that's no longer true. That we know that the brain is always changing, and that the stresses, what we can see on an fMRI, we can see the effect of stresses on an fMRI. We can see them both functionally, we can also see them structurally in the size of different parts of the brain. And that allostatic load, for example, which is the ability, so allostasis is the ability of an organism to adapt to stress. If you overwhelm that organism's ability, you get allostatic load. And the higher the allostatic load, the more chance that individual or organism will be ill. So this is not only affecting the below the neck, but above the neck as well. And because we know that there's a very strong association between the brain and the immune system, then we're also affecting below the neck by affecting the above the neck. So I just sort of talked about that. Now, interestingly, allostatic load increases sharply between ages 20 and 60, then levels off. Why? Because if you have a huge amount of allostatic load by the time you're 60, probably dead. So most people, the survivors are okay. The people who don't survive are not so okay. And there's there's a whole bunch of markers that, I imagine most people know this, that obesity together with diabetes is probably markers of social pathology just as much as is of anything else, that when we're talking about indigenous marginalized communities, when we're talking about type 2 diabetes is a political disease, especially among indigenous peoples. I mean, if you look at the rates of state, the quote perfect model, the Pima Indians, well, how come the Pima Indians who live in Mexico have much lower rates of diabetes than their genetically identical cousins who live above the border? It can't be because the genes. So we start to look at the politics of it. So just kind of going at the same slides twice. Developmental origins of health disease is just the idea that the prenatal and perhaps preconceptual environment programs the fetus. And the problem is that you have a mismatch. If you're programmed to have for a high glycemic load because your mother has gestational diabetes, that doesn't match up with your environment once you're born, and you don't have those high levels of circulating glucose. There's a whole bunch of principles, and this is easy to understand, a very simple chart of what's going on. You can see that there's so many different, it's important to understand that the placenta itself is modified, that maternal psychosocial stress, it's all at the ending down at the bottom with the outcomes that we see in Burfis and other studies. The end results are mediated by fetal programming. So it's very important not just to focus on the secondary, tertiary, quaternary prevention, is which I do as a physician, but we really need to do primary prevention. And if that's primary prevention, I think my hypothesis is that the primary prevention is actually political intervention. Intergenerational trauma, I'm probably running out of time, so it's just the idea that events in the past continue to affect us in the present. And that was first noted in children of survivors of the Holocaust, that children of survivors of the Holocaust actually had worse health outcomes than their parents, which one would not understand. Someone's undergone the Holocaust, and yet their children are feeling, and their children and grandchildren continue to experience those effects. Then the same thing was noticed obviously among Native Americans, American Indians, and the motto now is looked at in Native Hawaiians with studies showing like lower levels of cortisol reactivity, with the fact that the more traditional you are in terms of a culture of stress, the regardless of your ethnic blood quantum, the more the worse health outcomes you have. So leaving to what I'm currently working on and really interested in is epigenetics. That is the ultimate interaction of the organism and its environment to produce heritable changes in the non-coding parts of the chromosome. And to just look, genetics is just a single gene, and we know that for most chronic disease and for health overall, single gene things, they're very interesting and they're much easier to study, but they're probably not the picture. Whereas genomics is all the genes in the genome, including their interactions with themselves and with other environmental factors. So we have environment affects health and functions, and we have about 30,000 genes and about a million proteins. So this is just looking in 2008. These are all the misspelled DNA leading to disease. So what we're looking at is looking at diagnosis, risk assessment, gene therapy, and drug therapy. But what I would say is that this is really looking at the genealogy of how these big social factors are producing the disease, and that ultimately the drug therapy and the gene therapy is not going to be effective unless we change the context. It would be just the same when you have a person who's living in a food desert, a person who is socially marginalized, has a lot of social exclusion issues, and is morbidly obese. You give that person bariatric surgery, but then you return them to the same environment that they came from. Yeah, they will be, quote, cured of diabetes for a few years, but eventually you'll probably go back to the same problems because you're not changing the context that produced the disease. Now, we know there's a lot of non-genetic factors which influence risks. That's the environment, diet, and behavior. But the environment isn't just the pollution versus nice green plants and skies, but as we've been talking about, the historical context, the political content, the political environment, the social content. Social capital is, I mean, a key issue, but it's, of course, beyond the scope of this talk right now, to produce disease risk. So BRCA is a model, and perhaps most people in the room are familiar with the two-hit hypothesis for cancer, that BRCA is a tumor suppressor gene, but if you have methylation from epigenetic methylation, you have a knockout of one part of the gene, and then if you have knockout of the next part, then you have cancer. We can't restore the gene yet. So epigenetics may explain how the past and present environment had influenced our health, and it may lead to interventions that are different than most of us offer today. So these are more health. The animation didn't quite work. But what I wanted to talk about just in summary is that we need to construct a new discourse. And it has to be, when we're talking about indigenous health, and I would argue all health, that it has to be interdisciplinary, and it has to be incorporating all the from molecular techniques to macro political analysis, that we can no longer victimize the victim, because we know that actually a lot of people internalize that the patients that I talk to say, oh, my mom, my dad, my grandmother, they all had diabetes, I'm going to have diabetes. It's genetic. Well, yes and no. Maybe it's epigenetic, but it's probably not genetic. That this status and this learned helplessness, the helpless hopeless syndrome, is actually reconstructed by marginalization. For example, circumscribed self-determination in the Akaka Bill, trustee relationships over Hawaiian homelands, acceded lands, that you're in fact, just like with American Indians, you're not qualified to have full self-determination. You have to have this circumscribed self-determination. You have to be the beneficiary of a trust because you're not mature enough in some ways to take care of yourself. and a lack of control over, for example, the exclusive economic zone, which is 200 miles around the islands. Finally, epidemics may link social terms of health to health inequities, along with allostatic load, DOH, HAD, intergenerational trauma, that we need to trace the genealogy of health inequalities to restore causation agency, and we need to foreground policy and political change as key determinant of changes in health. That's it. Sure. So unfortunately, a lot of the research, which the research theories that I presented haven't been, the research hasn't been done among Native Hawaiians or other Pacific Islanders, but among Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, because it's mostly been them, and not so much Romani or other survivors, that we know that the children of survivors of the Holocaust would have much more chronic disease than would be expected from knowledge of their health risks. And so, looking at that, the theory of historical trauma, that is that people internalize and that this trauma, the knowledge and the memory of this trauma is culturally transmitted from generation to generation. And that as a result of that, that increases their chronic stress, their allostatic load, and that as a result of that, they become more ill. That until they come to reconciliation, some sort, that they'll never be able to sort of overcome that. And we know that when you look at the political sphere, that when you look at reconciliation, it's a huge thing. Like in South Africa, there was reconciliation after apartheid. And that for indigenous people, there has really been never reconciliation for indigenous people almost throughout the world. That if you look at a marginalized population, unless it's acknowledged that, yes, you've had this harm done, and then not just the acknowledgement, but then something done about it. And you could think in the American Indian context, that's huge, because that's most of the continent. For Hawaii, it's at least 1.8 million acres. So when we're talking about plus self-determination, it's a huge thing. And that to undergo this historical trauma, because I don't think any of us could imagine 95% depopulation in this room, you know. And so overcoming that, recognizing that, yeah, and we don't want to be angry about it anymore. We're not going to be sad about it anymore. We're not going to forget about it, but we're going to use that and use the knowledge of the ancestors to move forward. But you can't do that without addressing the issues.
In addition to the Pima Indians you mentioned, in the United States and Mexico, there's about 26 tribal nations right on the border. Have you looked at some of the others to see if that same phenomenon holds true?
I haven't, because that's not my particular, but I mean, I would be willing to venture that it's probably true, because we know that the poverty, which you would think that would work to accelerate, there's different versions of poverty, right? People, indigenous people in Mexico are very poor, yet they still continue to have access mostly to self-sufficiency in terms of growing their own diets and things like that. Whereas in among the Pima people, they're very dependent upon, just as in Hawaii, they're very dependent upon non-indigenous foods. And they have, you know, even water, and there's been key problems with water and things like that. So I would think that would probably hold true for the other nations along that border, the other tribes along that border.
Thank you. So you early on, I think you mentioned that power was an important process in dealing with the issue, and you mentioned the mad Hawaiians. So is that happening, that somehow Native Hawaiians are organizing and trying to refine power as a necessary stage towards better addressing some of the issues, historical issues?
Certainly, it's happening on a pretty large, and not I would say a large as for the total population, but there's many more. There's much more after the Hawaiian Renaissance in the 1970s with the Hokulea and other cultural changes. There's also political changes. I mean, Hawaiians became much more assertive, and there's many different initiatives at many different levels, from the United Nations to domestically, to reassert degrees of self-determination.
Thank you.